Hello and welcome back to The Bunker, home of the bite-sized political primer to smarten up your mornings. I'm Andrew Harrison. This time, we live in a world of borders. We argue over them. We obsess over them. We spend millions, build giant walls and warp our politics out of shape in order to secure them. And some of us are willing to kill large numbers of people in order to move them or just to keep them where they are. They're so deeply rooted in our way of life that we never question their legitimacy. Or imagine that a perimeter where one state abuts directly against another might not be a natural feature of the world at all, but a human creation as abstract and notional as money, love, or taxes. John Adledge, friend of the podcast and regular on Paper Cuts and Oh God What Now, knows this and he is fascinated by borders. He's written A History of the World in 47 Borders, the stories behind the lines on our maps. It's an exceptionally entertaining book which does exactly what it says on the tin and offers the bonus factor of being stuffed with entertaining did you knows to amaze your pals. Hello, John. It's been hours and hours since you were in this studio.
I know. I haven't been here since, about 90 minutes ago.
Right.
It's been great.
You might as well bring a sleeping bag.
Yeah.
So you make it very clear very early on in this marvellously entertaining book that borders are relatively recent inventions. The Earth was too sparsely populated for them even to be necessary. When did humans first start thinking in terms of an edge to their lives and their settlements?
So, yeah, in ancient history, it's more accurate to think of it as kind of like a centre and a periphery. Mm. Like if you kind of think about the Roman Empire, which, you know, by that point, the world's already getting quite populated, but mostly it doesn't face onto similar powers. You've got like, you know, the wilderness beyond. Like Caledonia was not like another nation. It was just a place that was kind of outside the empire. The only place where Rome kind of bordered another comparable state was in the east, where it bashes against Persia, leading to several centuries of war. So like you go back far enough and you've more got these kind of like islands of civilization in kind of like a sea of land. It's only in, I think we project the idea of the nation state back a lot further than it goes because like, you know, so much of the world was created by the English or the French. And those two nations kind of come about relatively early, about 1,000 years ago. But actually, like for much of history, like you still have that kind of center and periphery model. Like the borders in Europe kind of only really start settling down at the 17th, 18th centuries, really, when kind of unincorporated territories start getting eaten up by the bigger powers.
Mm. Do you think this feeds into this idea still, which is kind of at the back of or the bottom of our minds, that our border is the thing that keeps out the outside world? It's not the kind of line between two areas of equal significance. It's like us on the inside and everything else on the outside.
The whole thing is about us and them. It's about sort of delineating where we stop. And, you know, we can mean many different things. It can mean like the ability to kind of exert power over an area or sort of ethnic purity or whatever. But nonetheless, that is basically what is happening, is it is drawing a line between us and other people. And as you said in your very fine introduction, like if you search Google or, you know, Bing or whatever for like a map of the world, it will almost certainly present you a map of the countries of the world. And that's so ingrained in us that it takes a minute to think, well, hang on, that's not necessarily what that phrase means. Mm. Like there are other ways of seeing the world that don't have these kind of entirely man-made lines on them. But we're so used to them that that's kind of what we expect the world to look like.
Yeah, there are vast differences in territory within the United States that are far greater than the difference between, say, I don't know, Belgium and France and Germany. And yet we think of them as discrete countries, and the United States also is a discrete country, even though like, the middle of the Western Desert and the middle of New York City are utterly different.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so I think we sort of naturally, it's one of those assumptions that's so ingrained we don't realise we're making it. It's just kind of imagine that nation states are somehow the natural unit of politics, whereas actually they're very much a function of the last couple of hundred years. And generally, you look back through history, what you've got is you have empires and you have cities. Yeah. And in between, you don't really have anything.
What got you so fascinated in this that it enabled you to write this sustainingly interesting book?
So a couple of different things. Years ago, I used to edit a website for the New Statesman called City Metric, which was ostensibly about kind of urbanism and cities policy and so on. But because like no one was telling me what to do, I just kind of got into whatever I was into and the readers seemed to want, which is why I used to write a lot about minor changes in the tube map. but for that, I did a couple of pieces called Boundary Issues, which was just like, hey, this line on the map is fucking weird. So I did a few of them. Also, I've always been interested in kind of just like this broad sweep of history, like not just kind of like the last 50 years or something, but like how the hell the world happened, and have like read a lot of books to try and sort of teach myself about that. There's an excellent Radio 4 documentary strand called How to Invent a Country with Misha Glenny, produced by Miles Ward, which starts with like the invention of Spain or the invention of Germany. I can't remember which one. But that's kind of, that got me into a lot of these issues. And just a couple of years ago, when I was just trying to work out what to do with my life, my late fiance Agnes just said, you do realize there's a book here. And it's kind of a lovely format because I didn't need to come up with like a whole overarching thesis or narrative. I could just do lots of discrete chapters. So it's kind of doing like world history in an easy setting.
Well, one of the fascinating bits is digging into the Great Wall of China as a kind of test case of, you know, kind of how a border comes to be, what it is. And it made me realize, firstly, you point out, no, you can't see it from space.
That's a lie.
A huge, huge
that's
lie.
That's just not true.
Yes.
It's like 12 feet across. Of course you can't see it from space.
Yes. But also you point out that like it is not built kind of designedly with, you know, to keep one bit secure in the outside world of wildness and anarchy. It's kind of built piecemeal by different polities and different even phases of how people are governed. And you're never quite sure who's keeping what in and who's keeping what out.
Yeah, so like China, like lots of really old states, like Egypt is the same, has these periods of unity and these periods of fragmentation. And there's a period immediately running up to like the sort of rise of the Han Dynasty in the 3rd century BC called the Warring States period, which is exactly what it sounds like. And you've got all these kind of tiny kingdoms kicking the crap out of each other, and they start building walls to separate themselves from one another. And then it becomes like, you know, keeping up with the Joneses, keeping up with the Wangs, I suppose. You just keep building more and more walls to kind of show that you're as good as the next kingdom along. And then in 221 BC, the first unified emperor, Shuangdi, whose name I've just horribly mispronounced, makes it kind of like a nation-building project. It's like, well, we're going to finish these walls. We're going to make them as a defensive wall that runs all the way into the west. He's basically conscripting young men from across the empire to kind of build these things. Like, there's tragic poetry from the time about, yeah, like how people's lives are being wrecked by their sons being taken away, forced to build this wall. He only lasts about 15 years and is replaced in another dynasty. But it just kind of becomes this symbol of the unity of China. So at some points it is about keeping the sort of nomads to the north out, but at other points it's a communications artery. It's, yeah, a way of getting from east to west.
What's the weirdest border you encountered in the history of the world as you're rehearsing this stuff?
Oh God, there's bloody loads of them. My personal favourite, in a couple of different ways, partly because it shows the extent to which borders don't matter if you don't give them power, is there's a town called Bala in the south of the Netherlands. So it's actually two towns. The main one is called Baarle-Nassau. That's a Dutch town. But inside, there's lots of pockets of land called Baarle-Hertog, which are Belgian. Literally different buildings on the same street will be in different countries. And the rules are, if the border cuts through a building, it is allocated to whichever country has the front door. So people have literally moved the front door to switch countries because it's got better licensing laws or something. This is the thing that happened. But also, there's all this dates back to like the Holy Roman Empire in like the 12th century or something. And they've just kind of ended up in like, these bits of land ended up in the hands of different noble families. And eventually, you know, there's lots of subplots to this, but eventually this means that they get allocated to different countries in 1830. But what I like about it is, it doesn't bloody matter. Mm. Like these two countries, you know, Belgium literally declared its independence from the Netherlands. Like they were one country. There was like a bit of conflict in creating Belgium, but it still doesn't matter a blind bit. It's just two different towns that rub along in the same physical space with like probably some extra admin, but it just shows that like, you know, ultimately these borders are kind of meaningless.
Yeah, actually, what's the state of Indian River in the northeast of the United States where they haven't been incorporated into the United States or Canada? And they basically say, whoever conquers us first gets us, we don't mind.
Yeah, this is sometime in the early 19th century where, like, you know, there's still the border between the US and what is now Canada and was then British North America is a bit warrier in that period than it is today. But there is this area claimed by both countries because of a badly written treaty, which is something that comes up a lot, called the Treaty of Paris. And like they're basically being taxed by both sides, and they basically say, look, can you just settle this? We're declaring independence until someone sorts it out. So it's an independent state, the Republic of Indian Stream, for about 3 years until eventually the Americans turn up, conquer it, and they like basically write to the Canadian authorities and say, do you want to try and take us back? And when nobody comes, it's like, okay, cool, we're American.
That's quite a civilised way of doing
it. Yeah, it all sort of works out in the end. But yeah, there's lots of, like, history's got lots of these kind of tiny little microstates that kind of get left out of treaties or whatever, most of which get incorporated into something bigger at some point. But there are a few leftovers in Europe to this day, which is how you end up with places like San Marino, which is basically the top of a hill in Italy, which claims to date its independence to the 4th century. But that's a lie, because I'm fairly sure the Emperor Diocletian would have he would have considered that to be Roman territory. But they've just never been formally incorporated into Italy. And because it's up a mountain, it doesn't really have any resources. And it is quite useful having a tax haven your country can lean on. They've just let it be. It's basically the same reason like the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man are not actually part of the UK.
Just a handy little dodge.
It's partly that they've been left out. It's partly just like there was never a moment that they were actively incorporated. And it's partly also, if we're honest, that it's not worth it.
Yeah.
And it's not just that it's not worth it. It's also like, it's quite useful to have a place that's kind of outside your financial regulation sometimes.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned the great days of the Holy Roman Empire, which in this book, the Holy Roman Empire's crazy borders are richly entertaining in a Ruritanian style. I particularly liked the House of Royce, is it? Where all of the nobles are called Heinrich, and there's literally hundreds of them.
Yeah, because of the patronage of, I think, Heinrich the VI in like the 12th century, they decide that every son born to the family will also be named Heinrich. But they also start numbering them, whether they're kind of ruling princes or not. So you end up with, and also these territories are like constantly fracturing and merging. So you end up with this period where like there's like a Heinrich 25th, a Heinrich 37th, a Heinrich 48th, and so on, like all ruling different territories at the same time.
And they have to roll it over like car licenses as well. When
different territories do it different ways. Some of them, it's like they get to the end of the century and it's like, right, reset the numbering. And others of them say, okay, we're not going to let ourselves go above 100. But it does mean that, like, if a family has like 4 boys, they'll all be named like Heinrich consecutively. It's absolutely mad. There's also the Abbey of Prüm, which is literally just sort of like a big monastic building with some associated fields. And the only asset they've got is a pair of sandals, which they claim belong to Jesus, which they charge people to look at. And there's another independent state, the name of which escapes me right now, sorry, but it's like, it is literally just a nunnery for the unmarried daughters of the nobility. So they just dump the daughters they don't want there.
Would that be the Imperial Free Secular Foundation of Gandaheim?
Gandaheim. There we are, you see.
So I told you it was good stuff for the pub. Other good stuff for the pub, China, amongst China's methods of suppressing barbarity, are a set of towers across the empire, including one called the Tower for Suppressing Goat-like Foreigners.
Yeah, I mean, like, well, how do you deal with your goat-like foreigners?
Well, I'd start by not calling them goat-like because it might make them angry. There's also the fact that Genghis Khan's grandmother was called Alan.
Oh, yeah.
And she has sex with a smoke demon. And this at length produces the Mongol hordes and what you describe as the open borders policy of Genghis Khan, who I had no idea was such a progressive chap. Tell us how the borders of the Mongol Empire sort of feed into the creation of our world.
I mean, I think it does kind of give the lie to the idea that open borders are inherently progressive. Because Genghis Khan, like probably a lot of the things that we say he did were propaganda or actually things done by like Timurlek, who fans of Christopher Marlowe will know as Tamerlane a century or two later. But no, the Mongols did do a lot of conquering and marauding and killing people. But like they also, because they didn't have settled civilization, but they still wanted stuff. Whereas like, you know, the Chinese kind of looked down down on like manufacturers and merchants. The Mongols quite liked them because they brought them shiny things. So like once you were inside the Mongol Empire, you were probably all right. You probably had access to resources you didn't have before, just so long as you kind of surrendered to kind of Mongol domination. So this is the period called the Pax Mongolica, which was a golden age for like, you know, the Silk Road and free trade and so on right across Eurasia. But it did also, I think it kind of creates the conditions for the modern world in a number of ways. One of which is like, it scares the crap out of China, which then sort of bunkers down behind its wall, which the Ming dynasty are kind of reinforced against the Mongols.
Creating a mindset that persists to this day in many respects.
It also knocks out, like prior to that, the kind of the Arab empires had been like, you know, one of the world's great superpowers and they're conquered and they never really recover. It takes out Kiev and Rus, which was kind of quite a sort of progressive, democratic East European state, which is one of the ancestors of modern Russia. But the kind of the domination of the Russian lands passes to Moscow, which has very different, more paranoid policies because they've been conquered by the Mongols. But also, the Mongol invasions never quite reach Western Europe, but the sort of nice goods that kind of they allow to flow across Eurasia do. And there's a point where like the Black Death cuts that off. But by this point, the Europeans have got a taste for these luxuries. So some of them start building boats and going looking for them in other ways. So in all sorts of ways, like the Mongol Empire kind of sets the stage for really the whole of the last 500 years of human history. And I think we don't talk about that enough.
It is incredible the degree to which something like that can just set attitudes that will persist for half a century.
Yeah. Like this is also a point that's made in Tim Marshall's great book, Prisoners of Geography, is like a lot of Russian foreign policy is because there is a point in the 16th century they're conquered by the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and they've never quite got over it. And you can just march an army all the way from Europe into Moscow. So like the whole of Russian foreign policy since has been about pushing the border as far from Moscow as possible, which doesn't justify anything, but does explain things, I think.
Sort of coming closer to the modern world, I mean, I could not believe the stunning nonchalance of the partition of India, where 6 weeks before it was due to happen, they still had no idea of where the borders were going. And it was all pushed down to a civil servant called Sir Cyril Radcliffe, who kind of announced his decisions rather in the manner of which he would announce an X Factor winner and then left the country as fast as possible.
Oh yeah, he's on the record. There's a letter to his, I think, son-in-law in which he says, I want to be out of the country before it's announced because I know there's going to be literally 80 million people furious with me. So like the backstory to this, there's so many great details to this one. Like firstly, the British Empire is exhausted. They want out of India at this point. So they send Lord Mountbatten in as kind of the last viceroy with a deadline of, I think, 1948. There's riots kicking off between Hindus and Muslims, basically. Mountbatten takes one look at the situation and thinks, like, we can only lose here, brings the deadline forward so the British are going to get out in 1947 instead. At the same time, his wife, because they're in an open marriage, is beginning an affair with Nehru, who is in charge of the Congress Party, which is kind of the Hindu-Sikh majority party. So he's on holiday with the Mountbattens, looking at all the plans. Jinnah, the leader of the All India Muslim League and the first head of what will become Pakistan, doesn't know any of this. So like he is given, like he has shown the plans with like 12 hours to make a decision as to whether to accept them or not. Nehru has seen them weeks and weeks earlier because of who he's shagging. And yeah, they announce the division, the partition of India before they announce the border. So like, you know, several weeks later when the border is finally revealed, millions of people are on the wrong side and it all turns incredibly violent. Like suddenly friends and neighbors are like just coming to take your stuff, basically. So you get these two kind of caravans of sort of refugees basically passing each other at Amritsar or somewhere and just like trying to move to the right country. Yeah, and millions of people die from this.
Like up to 3 million people die, something between 12 and 18 million people have to move.
Yeah, and also it's like, it's an amazing story because, you know, everyone comes out badly. Like, you know, the British, by any reasonable definition, are going to come out worse. But it's not like the people dividing India on the ground or the people starting those riots are looking good either.
Yeah, and they don't teach this in schools. I wonder why we come out of it terribly. I've watched Britain become neurotic about its own borders in my lifetime. We used to have customs and excise and immigration, and now we've got border force, which sounds much more dramatic and assertive. Sounds like a really nasty kid's cartoon. Are we unusual in becoming more and more paranoid about our borders, or is that the way the world is heading?
It does feel like it's a bit of a pattern. I mean, like the conclusion to the book, I just kind of looked around at the news that week, and it's like, it is all about borders. Like, the war in Ukraine is because Vladimir Putin thinks the Ukrainians are basically Russians and this is Russian territory and the Ukrainians disagree. The Middle East right now is fundamentally about where Israel stops and something else begins, but also even much closer to home and in a much less sort of war-y fashion. You think of so many of the stories that dominated British politics recently, like everything to do with Northern Ireland and its sort of role post-Brexit is about the fact that effectively we'd abolished a border and then we've brought it back. Or like, you know, the debate about Scottish independence is whether there should be a border. The Channel boats crisis even is like effectively the border between us and the kind of the places that refugees are coming from was previously in the Mediterranean, but post-Brexit, because we're outside of European policy on this stuff, it's now in the Channel. So suddenly you get like, it just means that where once we were inside a system where the rule was like refugees would be returned to the first European country they arrive at. So it was all happening in Italy and Greece and so on. Now it's our problem. All these stories are fundamentally about the border of Britain and something else. And I find this quite interesting because, like, you know, we so many of the world's borders date from decisions made by the British Empire at some point. But yet it kind of feels like we sort of are in denial about changes to our own borders. Like, it feels like we've completely memory-holed the fact that what is now the Republic of Ireland was part of this country, not just in the British Empire. It was part of the United Kingdom until just over a century ago. And we just don't think about this stuff anymore. We kind of, like, completely ignore the fact that all these stories are about borders, really.
Yeah. I grew up with the kind of Gene Roddenberry Star Trek idea of a borderless future that, you know, that was what all science fiction sort of assumed. We'd be moving into an age of world governments and, you know, nationalities and borders would all blend. And I thought I'd be living in this kind of federated Star Trek future by the year 2024. In fact, borders are bigger, more important, more contested, more fetishized than ever. Was that idea that maybe they'd fade away? Was that a bit of a kind of a post-war utopian dream? Well, it'll never go away, really.
I think it was because, yeah, I'm also, as you know, a bit of a sci-fi nerd. And that is a thing in like all these franchises of like you get to a point where like there is a one world government or something. And to some extent, that's just because, like, if you're kind of writing something like Star Trek, I think it's easier to kind of imagine, like, you know, the Earth as a political unit. But it also does also come out of that sort of utopian post-war moment where, like, you know, we think we've abolished big wars. Things are moving in the right direction. There's growing prosperity and so on. And it's only in the last few years it started to become clear that history doesn't just move in one direction, that we can create more borders as well as to the strip them away. And like, obviously Brexit is a big indicator of that, but it's far from the only one.
Yeah. But all of these borders that you talked about, they've been creations of empire, but they've also been creations of the days of the city state when, you know, you'd look at a continent like Europe, it'd be like an archipelago of sort of walled communities. As the political organization changes, the nature of borders change. And we're kind of in the middle of a kind of digital revolution where the place where stuff is no longer a physical place. You know, there are supranational entities like Facebook and Meta and Google and all the rest of them. And there are moves to create supranational currencies. There are supranational, you know, organizations of all kinds. Will, you know, borders might always exist on the ground, but do they be as important in future?
No, I think that's entirely possible. I mean, circling back to kind of where we started, like, I think we all have this idea that the nation state is kind of natural and inevitable because it's been there for our entire life. But actually, if you get outside Europe, it's really a product of the last 100 years to a large extent. Like, it's not, which is nothing in historic terms. And like, I think you're right. There's going to come a point where, like, I mean, by any reasonable definition, probably Facebook already does have more power than, I don't know, Uzbekistan. So, like, I think you can certainly make an argument that the lines on the map are probably going to become less important, but I think they're always going to be there. I came out of writing this sort of discouraged about the Star Trek future. I just think, like, if you sort of Google a world map of the world in 100 years' time, you're still going to get a political map of the world. It will just look different.
Finally, amongst the crazy things I discovered, this is the preponderance of landlocked countries to have navies, even though they've got nowhere to put them to sea.
Yeah, my favourite of these is Bolivia, which lost its, it used to have a Department of the Littoral, which it lost in a war in sometime in the 19th century to Chile, which seems unfair because Chile already had quite a lot of coast.
Chile's nothing but coast.
It's coast on one side, mountains on the other. That's what Chile is.
Yeah.
But it's kind of left Bolivia landlocked. But it means it's this kind of key thing in the sort of national identity. Like one day they will get their coast back. So they still have a navy, sort of doing manoeuvres on Lake Titicaca. And, you know, once a year they celebrate the Day of the Sea, where like the navy kind of marches through the capital. Yeah, I just found that rather touching.
It's very touching. You can't get a boat to Bolivia. John Ellidge, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
A History of the World in 47 Borders, The Stories Behind the Lines on Our Maps, is out now, and you can buy it this very moment on the phone you're listening to this on. There's a buy link in the show notes. Not only will you be rewarding John for his fantastic work, but the bunk will benefit too, because we'll get a little bit of a cut. And if you really want to help us, there's always Patreon. For the price of half a pint each month, you'll be helping to support us during the current lean days of advertising. You'll be keeping us fit for a busy year ahead. Thanks for listening. I've been Andrew Harrison. This has been The Bunker, and we will see you next time.
I'm Rob Hutton, and I grew up watching war movies with my dad, but my kids just don't get it. So I had to find someone to watch them with me.
And that's me, Duncan Weldon, and I do get it. So I was only too happy to join Rob and guests such as Al Murray, Helen Lewis, and Satim Sangera as we rewatch the greatest war movies of all time.
So join us on War Movie Theatre to talk about classics from Where Eagles Dare to Zulu to The Sound of Music.
That's War Movie Theatre, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Group Editor Andrew Harrison. The producer was Liam Tate, the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey, and the managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.